Hello and welcome to another episode of the Emergency Docs. I'm Dr. R. Please keep in mind that the content of this episode does not constitute medical advice, but is purely for the purpose of education. This episode was supported by the National Geographic Society's Emergency Fund for Journalists. This episode is part of our series on social determinants of health. Today, we have a few fantastic guests who are here to discuss human trafficking. It's a topic that's not often discussed, but is still, unfortunately, more prevalent than it should be. In the emergency department, we're well-positioned to look for signs of human trafficking and provide a safe haven for victims. In this episode, we'll discuss what human trafficking is, who the victims commonly are, and signs that you can look for, and finally, some stories about actual cases of human trafficking. Some of the topics we will discuss today can be difficult to hear and think about, especially for those who may have experienced sexual or interpersonal violence. Joining us today is Dr. Victor Cisneros, host of our Social EM series. Dr. Cisneros, I'll let you take it from here.
Thanks, Dr. R. It's a pleasure to be back in another episode of the Social EM series, and I'm so excited to have Dr. Ronnie Rivera and Lisa Murdoch, who I've had the pleasure of working with them both. You know, during fellowship, I had Dr. Rivera on my side working in the emergency department and Lisa with a couple projects from food insecurity to now, you know, talking about human trafficking. So I have the pleasure to be introducing Dr. Rivera, who is an emergency medicine physician and fellow of multimedia design and education technology, MedEd Tech, at the University of California, Irvine. He completed his medical school at UCLA, David Geffen School of Medicine, and then went on to do residency at SUNY Downstate, Kings County, and Brooklyn, New York. After elected to being chief of education, he discovered his passion for teaching his peers much in the same way as they advocated for improving bedside patient education as part of patient-centered care. He is currently completing a master's in education focused on digital age learning and technology at Johns Hopkins University with the hopes of creating a free public health access health literacy education series. Wow. Currently, projects include teaching techniques for improving bedside interactions with patients from at-risk patient populations and educating on improving social determinants of health from the emergency department.
Welcome, Dr. Rivera.
Thank you.
And I will be introducing Lisa Murdoch, who is an acute care pediatric nurse at Children's Hospital Orange County and a pediatric clinical nursing professor. Over the past 22 years, she's worked in pediatric acute care in several children's hospitals across the country and in Puerto Rico. Lisa began her journey in anti-trafficking efforts after meeting a survivor in 2014. This meeting inspired her to continue these efforts by expanding healthcare provider education on human trafficking and working to implement evidence-based protocols for inpatient pediatric hospitals. She believes that as a nurse, it is imperative to actively educate and raise awareness on human trafficking among healthcare providers, and to implement a multidisciplinary approach to anti-trafficking efforts, including screening, response, and collaborating with outpatient service agencies. Currently, she serves on the Orange County Human Trafficking Task Force Healthcare Subcommittee and CSEC Resource Committee. So thank you both for joining the episode today. All right, so let's get started. What is human trafficking?
So, you know, according to the TVPA, which is the Trafficking Victims Protection Act from 2000, which many people might not be aware of, but it was, you know, the first comprehensive kind of federal approach to addressing human trafficking. So according to that definition, human trafficking is the crime where force, fraud, and coercion is used to exploit somebody for labor services as well as commercial sex acts. I think because I look at it from a pediatric standpoint, so I'm always looking from 18 years and under, that also includes youth, specifically sex trafficking, youth who perform commercial sex acts in exchange for something of value. So for example, survival sex does fall under that umbrella of exploitation.
Absolutely. And I think it's really great that you brought in the pediatric portion of it, because I typically try to think about the definition of human trafficking from the perspective of an action, a purpose, and a means. So when you think about an action, this is something like a recruiting, harboring, transporting, providing, obtaining, or advertising the individual that is being trafficked. And then it has to be done in order to exploit the purpose, right? Exploit, capitalize, or force them into labor or sex. And when you think about it from the minor's perspective, they only need an action and a purpose because minors don't have a mean. So for example, for an adult, the means would be by force, by like starvation, physical abuse, or isolation, or fraud by false promises of citizenship or money, or coercion through threats or blackmail, or deception altogether. So when you think about it, for an adult, you need the action, the purpose, and the means. But for a child, you only need action and a purpose because children don't have means to provide for themselves. So it actually puts children at a much higher risk by the definition of being victims of trafficking.
Yeah, and just to add to that, so in children 18 and under, you do not have to prove force, fraud, and coercion. So if you are seeing somebody that is exchanging sex for a place to stay, food, things of value, you don't have to prove force, fraud, and coercion. So as mandated reporters, that definitely falls under that responsibility.
Yeah, that sounds very complex. And as a medical provider, I have never really been familiarized with a lot of the different characteristics or definitions surrounding human trafficking. A lot of times when I see a patient that I might have concern for coercion or some sort of inappropriate relationship, it's not as clear or as legal. And it's really just kind of based on a sense of the things that this patient are telling me aren't adding up. So as medical providers, I guess when we have that sense that something is not right, is there anything that we can do to address some of those specific criteria that you just brought up?
Yeah, I don't want to tell physicians what to do. So I've been in this situation before where, you know, a lot of things need to be peer-to-peer, but from a nursing perspective, yeah, there's definitely things to do, especially using a trauma-informed approach. Building a rapport before, you know, with the patient, before you start asking those questions, asking the questions in a trauma-informed way, which a lot of survivors, they might not use trauma-informed, for example, but in a qualitative study I just completed, they said, if someone asked me questions in a gentle way, that would have helped disclose. And then in addition to that, as you're building a rapport and creating a safe space for them to disclose, being transparent, especially with youth under 18, so many of them fear healthcare providers because they've been manipulated into thinking you're going to get in trouble. Trafficking is a crime, you're going to get in trouble. And then, of course, as healthcare providers, as mandated reporters, we have to call CPS and we have to call law enforcement, right? So we're kind of basically confirming what they've been taught is true. So I think being transparent with them that we do have to call, but it's to protect you. You're not committing the crime. We're actually calling to ensure you're safe because the other person is committing the crime against you. And so I think it's really important to be transparent and to actually explain that's going to happen and also not leave them alone if we do have to call law enforcement, if they want somebody to be at the bedside to ensure someone they trust and someone they build a rapport with is at the bedside with them during that process.
You bring up such an important point about trauma-informed care. And I think that this is something we hear very frequently in the emergency department. And it's a term that isn't always well defined in our minds as what exactly is trauma-informed care. So I try to remember that trauma-informed care is trying to get into the head and the perspective of the person who's experienced the trauma so that we understand, you know, that the person's behaviors, the person's responses to what we say or do may not seem appropriate or may be angry or may be violent or may be very emotional, but we have to be okay with that because we understand that they've been through a traumatic experience and that they're unlikely to respond as we might expect them to or want them to because of that trauma. So we have to respect that, especially when someone says that they have hesitancy about reporting, right? Because this is an agency they may not have been given during the period that they were being trafficked. This may be the first time they've ever been able to exercise their right to say no to somebody. And if that's what they say no to us, we do definitely have to respect that. And then we also have to normalize the behavior and let them know how common this is and that there is nothing wrong with for being a victim of this and that we can just show empathy and avoid judgment in all of our statements. And that's really the trauma-informed approach, is using our own empathy, avoiding judgment, and accepting that somebody may have maladaptive behaviors in response to this trauma that we can maneuver around in order to help them.
Yeah. And to also to add to that, if you actually as a healthcare provider screen for your own adverse childhood experiences, you can even evaluate your own triggers. So when you're dealing with somebody who has been through a lot of trauma, that might even trigger the healthcare provider. So really, in order to implement trauma-informed care, it's great to assess your own triggers as well. And there are some tools to help providers out implementing trauma-informed care because it is so complex. The PARR tool, so it's an acronym, P-E-A-R-R, created by Common Spirit in collaboration with Heal Trafficking. It literally walks you through each steps. Like provide privacy, educate, ask, respect, and respond. And then that way, it's just a tool for everyone to use because maybe everybody doesn't have you know, training on the neurobiology of trauma and how to actually implement it as a skill. So if you have that little tool, we can actually do that on, you know, kind of more comprehensive approach.
You bring up a really great point as far as a lot of our listeners are not trained in medicine and may not encounter somebody in the emergency department or in a clinic. But is there a way that people from non-medical backgrounds can also provide appropriate assistance to victims of human trafficking?
Yeah, so they can call the national hotline. You know, if you're not in a healthcare facility, there is a national hotline that you can call. I think it's really tricky with human trafficking because many times people are basing it on the media presentation of what human trafficking looks like. And that really creates kind of misconceptions of human trafficking based on sensationalized imaging, the Taken movie where many victims are kidnapped. And I think that's really important to point out that in order for us to actually educate the public and healthcare providers, we need to have an accurate representation. It's not just limited to sex trafficking. It also includes labor trafficking, which can be done through domestic servitude, agriculture, even healthcare providers, nursing homes. This is really pervasive in even in youth as well. So I think it's really important to point that out as well. It's not as easy as what you might see in the media.
Lisa, you bring up such a good point because I think that in order to understand human trafficking, we really have to have a sense of some of the statistics and what do the victims of human trafficking look like. If we look at the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services reports on human trafficking, about 21 million people in the world are forced to live in conditions of forced labor or sexual servitude. There's about 14 to 17,000 foreign nationals that are trafficked through the United States each year. That's not including U.S. citizens who are trafficked. About 100 to 300,000 children are at risk each year for the commercial sex trade. If you think about it globally, there's about 124 out of 195 countries have reported cases of human trafficking. 67% of trafficking is sex trafficking. 13% is believed to be for undocumented citizens. 49% are women. 21% are girls. 18% men. 12% boys. And that's expected to be underreported because of societal expectations about men and boys and their ability to be sex trafficked. And then important for us in the ER to know that 63% of victims have reported being visiting an ER and seeing a physician in ER at some point during their sex trafficking. Like you talked about, the most common categories being sex and labor trafficking. I think when we talk about sex trafficking, we always think about sex in exchange for money or goods, right? So sex for drugs or sex for money. But we have to remember that stripping and prostitution are also forms of sex trafficking. Pornography, if someone's being forced to perform either for like live video shows or photographs. Mail order brides is another form of international trafficking. Sex tourism, where people are traveling and looking to, you know, to have sex with people in different countries or people from different countries. And then commercial phone sex lines is one we don't think about also, where people can be forced to work these phone sex lines. And I think you brought up a couple of great categories for labor trafficking as well, as those are the two most common categories. But I try to think about domestic work as another one that we don't think about too often. People who are being brought over to work in hotels or in restaurants as chefs or cleaning services for large companies. We also have to think about peddling and begging. People can be brought over and put on street corners and asked to beg for money. And then agricultural and animal husbandry. So things like bringing people over to work on farms and to pick fruit here in California, especially. Construction jobs are also labor trafficked as well, where somebody may be working construction, but not necessarily getting paid. The person who brought all of the workers over is getting paid. We talked about hotels and hospitality, health and beauty services as well. And then carnivals is another one I never thought about, but seems to be a common one as well. People working in carnivals.
What about social media or use of the internet? Has that increased sex trafficking, or has that contributed to any changes in the market?
Definitely. And I think, you know, when you look at the impact that COVID had as well on both trafficking and then also anti-trafficking efforts, that really impacted because many traffickers then transitioned to online means and residential brothels. So I think, you know, that is a excellent point to bring up. And then when you're thinking about prevention, that's why it's so important, especially in pediatrics from the prevention standpoint, is to really teach about online safety.
This is amazing. I love this team approach, having, you know, both perspectives from your guys. I think just to summarize for our listeners, I think it's important to kind of define human trafficking, you know, keeping an open mind that it's not a cookie cutter definition. It includes a lot of different populations. And then obviously this might be underreported because there's a lot of these populations that might not, you know, be reporting true statistics like undocumented, you know, people that are being trafficked. So I think it's a very complex issue. And I think just keeping an open mind and keeping kind of that little spider sense in the back of us as healthcare providers, realizing that it's a team approach, as we have a physician here and an RN. And a lot of times, you know, the RNs are the ones in the bedside spending more time with patients and kind of give us those signs. We spend like a couple minutes here and there, especially in the emergency department. So from your guys' point of view, maybe Lisa from pediatrics and Dr. Rivera from the adult world, what would be the most common patient population that we could potentially encounter in the emergency department? Obviously, it could be all of the above, but is there one that we keep re-encountering or that we should be keeping an eye out for most?
So, you know, that is a really interesting and kind of difficult question because, you know, I don't want people to focus on like one population because that's what really happens with having things be so missed or underdocumented is because we're not really asking the sensitive questions. And if you really look at barriers to disclosure or challenges with identification, there's both provider related as well as survivor related, right? But I would say, if you screen for ACEs, like many of the youth had a history of foster care, being in dependency situations, experiencing homelessness, and really being contacted within 48 hours of experiencing homelessness that a trafficker had approached them with either, you know, lucrative job offers that were fraudulent. So I think it's hard for me to really pinpoint which population because I don't want to exclude other vulnerable populations within that vulnerable population, like male patients, LGBTQ plus community, that's even more underdocumented because people are so focused on female victims of sex trafficking and really missing out on labor trafficking and other more vulnerable populations.
Yeah. And it's really interesting because we see a big focus in our political context now on trafficking at the border, right? For immigrants who are being trafficked at the border, which probably makes up close to 13% of trafficking in general is this like trafficking of illegal immigrants around the border. So I think it's really important for all of us to understand who in our particular areas could be trafficked and understand what are the most common areas for the places that we live and work. And when you think about some of this, the main statistics about trafficking, things like 36% of traffickers are immediate family members, and then another 27% boyfriends, and then 14% are friends of family, leaving 15% as employers and 9% as strangers. So when you're thinking about the actual statistics of who gets trafficked, it's, as you said, Lisa, vulnerable populations. Anybody who's at risk is going to have their risk of trafficking amplified infinitely. And like you said, LGBT, people who have drug addictions or who need substances, those people as well. People who are in unstable relationships or have history of unstable or abusive relationships in the past. People who are victims of interpersonal violence are often more likely to end up in trafficking situations because of the relationships that they're in. So these are things that we should know about our own individual areas. If you live in California, you should understand those places. Or if you live on the East Coast, you should understand what's the most common. And most city and state websites will have statistics that allow you to review what the most common forms are so that you can become more familiar and kind of hone your approach to tracking it down.
I think what's really shocking to me about the statistics that you just read were only 9% are trafficked by strangers. So that leaves the other 91% as people that the patient or the victim knows, which is just, I mean, it's baffling when I think about it. And so what we're really looking for in a lot of these situations is someone who has an unusual relationship with a family member or a friend or significant other.
And I think that's why it's so important as well as healthcare providers that when we're creating a safe space and building a rapport, and then we are asking the sensitive questions is to try to interview that patient alone, because many times they are with somebody. The study that I just finished, multiple were actually trafficked by family members. And then similar to that research just in Orange County alone, 71 were recruited by people they knew. So I think that's why it's really important to use a professional interpreter if you do need an interpreter. And then if you need to get that patient alone, that's going to be really key in assisting with the disclosure process.
And I often get asked when people say, how do you get your patient alone, right? When you are worried that there's something going on, how do you get the patient alone? And what I love is a couple of things came up. One is, I don't know if you've been to an airport recently, but a lot of airport bathrooms or ports of service have signs in the bathroom stalls that have a phone number that you can call or text. If you text Be Free, like B-E-F-R-E-E, to this phone number, it connects you 24/7 to somebody who can text back and forth with you about resources and get you help for trafficking. So having signs in the bathrooms in your clinic or in your hospital where people will go in the places you expect them to be alone or private are great ways to provide resources or pamphlets. Other things you can do is if you need imaging on your patient, right? You can meet your patient alone in the imaging area and then discuss with them when they're, whoever's accompanying them isn't around. Because a lot of times the person who's with them is going to be the person who's doing the trafficking, and that person isn't going to want you to separate the patient from them. And that's actually one of the key signs that you should be looking for when somebody is potentially being trafficked. Things you can do is if you do talk to somebody and you want to provide resources to them, you can give them hospital socks and put the information in the hospital socks, fold it up in the sock so they can put the sock on it. It's in the bottom of their sock in the shoe. You know, other excuses you can think of is, you know, I always, with working with pediatric populations, set out from the beginning with the parents saying, I interview one part with all of us together, one part with the patient alone, and one part with the parents alone. And then we'll all come back together and make a plan. So setting that up in advance so that they understand how the interview is going to go and they're expecting that they're going to get separated at some point are great ways to start to be able to address it.
Are there particular brands or marks or signs that clinicians or the public can look for signs of human trafficking?
Absolutely. So if from the medical perspective, let's look at some of the most common things that you can see in a medical setting. And then this brands and marks come with this also. I try to separate it out into categories like responses, companions, medical issues, appearances, and other. So when you think about response-based red flags, things like rehearsed or scripted responses from the individual, or they're unwilling to speak, even though they're able to speak and someone does a lot of speaking for them. If their history is inconsistent or vague, or they seem to be unaware of like the location or the time, or don't have personal information such as like their home address or their home phone number, or information about how they could get home if they were discharged. Companion-based things are someone who might be over-controlling, or someone who's completing the paperwork for the patient, speaks for the patient, has control of their ID or passport and does not give that back to the patient when they're done. Or again, we talked about before, refuses to leave the patient alone. For medical history, just inconsistent or vague histories, histories that are inconsistent with the exam or the injury that they're being evaluated for. Appearance issues, we talk about inappropriate or ill-fitting clothing. An unexpected demeanor, so somebody who seems irritable or anxious or has a really flat affect in a situation where you wouldn't expect that. Lack of eye contact that's not culturally related can also be a red flag. Some may have large amounts of cash or condoms or hotel keys on themselves and on their person. And then they may not have many personal items, or the person may be controlling their cell phone and not let them have their cell phone back. When we talk about skin or tattoos or brands, we think about tattoos in the inner lip area or tattoos on the neck or the back of the neck. There have been brands that have been reported, and several websites will show you brands that are considered consistent with human trafficking. Other things, there's a tattoo that's very common that has a crown with the name of the person who is the handler. So it's like a crown on their name that kind of is associated with trafficking often. And on the physical exam, we should be looking for things like malnutrition, also dehydration, physical exhaustion from possible labor as well. And then on skin examination, we talk about bites and burns and ligament marks or ligature wounds, bruises, traumatic alopecia, where somebody may have had their hair pulled and had chunks of hair pulled out, or scars or unhealed wounds or wounds in various stages of healing. Another area I believe is common for tattoos is we talk about neck, inner thigh, and lip, and under hair is another one that I try to think about as well.
Just going to add to that as well is like cutting or self-harm. And then a lot of times it's in inconspicuous areas. So that's why the assessment is so important. So when you're using a trauma-informed approach, to give some element of control, so you're not just asking them to take their gown off, for example. There have been survivors that their trafficker has made them undress to make sure they're not hiding money anywhere. So just by you asking to see skin and have them take their clothes off to put the gown on could be re-traumatizing. So really entering that exam using a trauma-informed approach, but just being aware that a lot of these things might not be apparent. And then in addition to having somebody with them, a lot of survivors are just dropped off by themselves, especially youth under 18 being dropped off at the emergency department. I also want to say that it's not limited to, you know, injuries or STIs or some of the other high-risk categories, but just chronic diseases. So asthmatics, diabetics, people in DKA. So it might be other, you know, regular chronic illnesses that we are seeing, but you're seeing inconsistencies in the story. They don't know how they got there. So other things that we should be looking for, just not based on those kind of high risk categories, where asking the questions and really using a screening tool is going to be helpful for us.
You bring up such a good point about framing everything that we do in the emergency room. And I think that's a huge approach to trauma-informed care, is that when we examine any patient or we touch any patient, it's so helpful for us to frame what we're asking in the context of why we're asking it, and then explain what we're going to do and where we're going to touch before we do that. Because patients give us a lot of leeway with their bodies. And so we want to be as respectful as possible as we can with that. So saying things like, for most of my patients who come in with lower abdominal pain, I think about things like sexually transmitted infections, et cetera, et cetera. Have you been having any unprotected sex or whatnot? But letting them know why you're asking the question before asking the question allows them to have a context within which to respond and understand that it's not just a random question, or you're not trying to get information out of them that's not important.
Yeah, and I think it's really understanding complex trauma as well. You know, with a single episode of trauma, you have time to recover. With survivors of human trafficking, they have repeated events of trauma over sometimes a long period of time. So a lot of times they're coming in terrified, even though they might not come off as being terrified. Could I read a quote from a survivor about this? So she says, "We are terrified. Every person that walks through the door, we do think it's either a client or a pimp or a friend of a pimp. We do not know. And then it gets to the point we are sitting there for so long, we get up and leave. Sometimes we don't even make it past the front desk because it's terrifying. Like, we don't want to sit there. You don't want to be seen. You don't want to be exposed. It's like one of the scariest, especially when you're a child." So I think it's really important for healthcare providers to know that they are terrified and they're kind of coming into this emergency room with a different power dynamic, right? And sometimes I think we forget about that power dynamic.
And that's the most important part, is that we can give the power back to the individual. I think it's also important when we talk about this trauma-informed approach to care, is understanding why might someone be afraid, or why might someone not want to report that they've been a victim of or a survivor of human trafficking. And so a couple of reasons why, to help put us in their perspective or in their heads a little bit. One is there's a need for safety, right? This person who is holding them or trafficking them may instill a need or a fear of authorities or immigration, saying that if you report this, you're going to be deported or you're going to be arrested. Or they may create a stigma or a shame about them being a victim and saying, hey, you know, this is your fault. You did this. Other things are, we talk about need for chemicals. So someone might have a forced dependency on drugs, or might be using drugs as a means for coping with the experience. And they rely on that person to provide the drugs that allow them to cope with this experience that they're going through. We talk about intimate partners and boyfriends or spouses being some of the primary perpetrators of trafficking. So sometimes there's a need for love or connectedness, where someone has a Stockholm syndrome or forms some sort of trauma bond with the person that's trafficking them. And that may be a reason why they're not willing or able to report that person or want to report that person. Sometimes it's really down to just survival needs, right? Somebody might be threatening their children or their family back home, or their fellow victims who are with them, saying that if they don't go to the doctor or if they don't do what they're being told to do, someone's going to get hurt who's not them. They may be isolated or deprived of food and water, emotionally or physically abused. They may not have their identification. These people can sometimes take IDs and passports and basically take away their options for escape or to get away, because they don't have any way of living or identifying themselves after they leave. Then there's also the need for food, water, and shelter. We talk about labor trafficking, and a lot of these people have to live in certain conditions, and they're only allotted a certain amount of food or water in these conditions. And they're afraid that if they leave, they'll be in a remote part of the world where they won't be able to survive. And then there's the personal part of it, which is the shame, right? Someone who might feel shame that they were coerced into this by a loved one or a family member, or shame that they were complicit in what's been going on, that they may be to blame for this. And so a lot of these reasons combine together to make someone not want to seek out care from a healthcare clinician or healthcare assistant, or even from law enforcement, because they may have these fears. So it's important for us to get into that frame of reference and understand those things when we're trying to help an individual.
I think you've just outlined so many different barriers, essentially, to these patients coming in and getting care. And so by the time someone sees you as a medical provider, you know, they've already overcome so many of those barriers. And so I love that you really highlighted how important it is for us to be empathetic and cognizant of their perspective and sort of where they're coming from in this situation, and remembering that if they are abrasive in their conversation with us, that it doesn't necessarily mean that they don't want help or don't need help, but it has to do with a lot of those power dynamics and the background of where they're coming from and what they've been through. So I just really appreciate that you highlighted all of those things and things that we should be remembering and keeping in perspective when we're interviewing and talking to these patients.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think it's so important that you guys highlighted at least some tangible signs and things that we can kind of identify. I think the tattoos was a very thing that I just encountered at a community hospital that I work in part-time. There's a female that was dropped off early in the morning, believe it or not, after supposedly she was partying by her boyfriend, allegedly dropped her in the emergency. She was altered. And I think what kind of, you know, one of the things that I teach my residents, you have to undress the patient automatically because she was, you know, not completely undressed. We undressed her and she had marks, like finger marks in areas that she didn't have. I look in the back of her neck and she had a tattoo, which is a barcode, which a lot of times, you know, I learned that that's very common, especially in Europe. A lot of times the numbers don't necessarily always mean anything, but sometimes it means the amount of debt that they're owed. And at the end of the, you know, we found out when, once we were, she was very refractive. When she kind of, she was intoxicated. I guess she was put on a bunch of drugs and she was kind of pretty much altered most of the time. We found out that she was living in a house with like five other girls, you know, and the question is now, what do we do? The nurses didn't know. You know, they wanted to call authorities. And I was like, no, let's not call authorities right away because she's going to probably leave. She's afraid of the cops. I guess the cops had been multiple times to this household, but they never did anything, you know, because there's some suspicions, but they never had anything tangible. Long story short, you know, it's like, is there anything from your guys's perspective in place? You know, now we have this victim here, we identified in the emergency department. What do we do next? You know, how do, as healthcare providers, nurses, this community small hospital didn't single coverage. I was the only ER doc with 30 bed. And I found out that this county, I'm not going to disclose, one of the number one counties of human trafficking in Southern California, which I didn't even know. What do we do next? And they didn't even have any guidelines. They didn't have policies. So, you know, luckily I was there and I was able to kind of mitigate the team and kind of stop them from contacting the authorities and kind of protecting her. We changed her the dough. I said, nobody can come in and allowed to, she doesn't exist. She's not in the emergency department. Change her name. Boyfriend's not allowed. We told her that we said she's positive for COVID, so she can't come. Nobody can come near her. And so, you know, till we got more information, but is there any guidelines in place, organization, anything that we can do, you know, or providers can do?
Yeah. So one, I have like my five pillar approach, but number one is ensuring that you have like an accredited educational program that provides accurate education on human trafficking and trauma-informed care for all your employees. So whether that's in your new hires or your annual ACEs, I think that's going to be really important. And also to point out, you know, for nurses and physicians, you might need a higher level of what that looks like. But just having an educational program for all your employees, because there's been many times where environmental services, patient care techs, they have been the ones to actually see some kind of inconsistencies or red flags to notify us. Having a screening tool validated for your patient population, because of the challenges and barriers to disclosure, they're not going to come up and just disclose to you that they've been trafficked. Many youth especially, they don't even identify as a victim. A lot of times when they say boyfriend, they really think that person is their boyfriend. And they might be manipulated into thinking, he's my boyfriend, we just need to do this because we need to save money for our future. So they might not even identify as a victim. So that's why it's so important to have a screening tool. And then once you've educated and you've identified, having a patient response algorithm based on your department, so and your population. So my algorithm on pediatrics might look different from like an adult ER, for example, because as mandated reporters, we do have to call CPS to do a car report and have to call law enforcement, where in the adult world, you're definitely not going to do that. And you're going to want to get consent from that person to see if you want to call victim services or you want to call law enforcement. And then really having an institutional policy and then resource provision. So you're actually connecting that person with outpatient resources upon discharge. So I think that's important as well, because you want to plant the seed. It's not a one and done. So many people think like, once you identify people, we're all set. Here we go. And that's not the situation, especially youth that are being discharged to foster care or a group home. There have been youth that are actually recruited through foster care and group homes. they can run away. So it's really important to link up. For example, in Orange County, we have a drop-in center for commercially sexually exploited youth. We have victim services. We have transitional programs. It's really important to kind of give them some kind of resources and then also their experience in the hospital. If we can create a safe space, then they will be more apt to come back to us when they need the help instead of looking at it like, I'm not going back there. I have survivors that are like, I just don't trust healthcare. I had a really bad experience. A youth that was actually pregnant during focus group interviews through this qualitative study was like, sometimes even with my first child, I just Wikipedia things and only go if it's critical. So I think that's going to be really important, is creating that safe space so they know they can come to us, no matter how many times, without being called a frequent flyer or non-compliant. Like, I have another youth that has diabetes that was considered non-compliant, so they wouldn't give her an insulin pump. So, you know, it's really engaging with them, meeting them where they're at, planting the seed, and ensuring that they're getting services all along the way.
Yeah, as you pointed out, so many of these patients don't recognize that they're victims. They don't even recognize that this is something that is not normal, sort of because of the narrative that they've been given over whatever period of time. So I think as medical providers, one of the things, like you said, that is so important that we can do is provide resources and that safe place, so that if they do recognize that situation that they're in is not ideal or not appropriate, that they know where they can go, who they can call, who they can text, you know, what they can do.
Lisa, you brought up such a great part about screening in the emergency room. There are four questions that I think that have been pretty well validated. When you can use all four, it's the best. But if you can even use a couple of them with your patients when you have suspicions, or if you can set up a policy in your triaging that asks these questions, just like you might do a depression screening in the emergency room on all patients who come through, these four questions can also be good screens for interpersonal violence and trafficking. So question one is, do you currently feel unsafe? Is a yes or no question. Have you ever been slapped, kicked, hit, or physically hurt by someone in the past year? Are you currently in or have you been in an abusive relationship? Or have you ever been pressured or forced to have sex? So those four questions can be done as a screening and can help to identify potential cases where we need to dig deeper and give people an opportunity to disclose if they're a survivor of trafficking. So those are four screening ones that have been validated in the emergency room for use, and it's been suggested they can be used in clinics as well. You also brought up such a great point about the team. I think maybe, Victor, your story kind of highlights this the most, because as one single physician, as one single individual, you can't do all of this alone. You can't screen the patients. You can't fix the situation. You can't get all the paperwork done. So you've got to get help, right? You have to have a team approach to this, as Lisa said. And so you've got to work with your social workers. You've got to work with your hospital medical legal representatives and put the team together. Whether you need like SART, a sexual assault response team for instances of sexual assault. Another thing is with our documentation as well. We have to be really careful with how we document for these patients, making sure that we only put in medically relevant facts and supporting details. We have to avoid words like, you know, consistent with, or possibly this, or make our own assumptions about what could have potentially gone on, instead of just reporting only the facts. Also, if we need more detailed accounts of things, there are medical legal representatives who work with state and local officials who can help with the proper documentation, the photography, and those kinds of things. We have to also take pictures if possible, or use drawings with scales in them so that we can say how large tattoos are or how large marks were. And then asking the patient for consent before any of these things are done. We talked about consent before exam, but also consent before taking photos and making sure that at each step in this, we get some consent from the patient. So those are some of the things that I think we can do from the medical perspective. Other resources that I like are that we talked about, the National Human Trafficking Resource Center hotline, which is free number 888-373-7888, which people can call 24/7. We also talked about texting Be Free to 233-733, which is basically the numeric for Be Free. Things that people should know about as well for patients who are non-immigrants, who are victims of trafficking, there are two kinds of visas in the United States. There's a T visa and a U visa that allow someone who has non-immigrant status to obtain status while they're working with law enforcement. So it's a way for people who are concerned that they're going to be deported or they're going to be arrested to actually have a pathway to citizenship by helping to bring tearing down the trafficking ring. The U.S. Citizen and Immigration Services Department, they have something through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services called the Blue Campaign, which is great to look into. They have a lot of training resources for medical professionals so that you can take courses. There's like an hour course online that you can take as well. There's a group called the Polaris Project. And then there's SOAR, which is Stop, Observe, Ask, Respond to Human Trafficking. And then there, I believe, Lisa, you brought up CAST earlier, the Coalition to Abolish Slavery and Trafficking, which is another group that you can refer to as well for resources.
There's a few others. So HEAL Trafficking, which is health, education, advocacy, and linkage. They also have a multidisciplinary team of people that, I mean, a source for education, research. They also have a hospital protocol toolkit. So you can literally go through their protocol toolkit and building policy. They also have an educational assessment tool. So as you're rolling out your own education, you can actually go through the checklist to ensure that, you know, you're being responsible and then also comprehensive on your training. In addition to that, they have a train the trainers program between HEAL Trafficking and Mass General Hospital. So if you have somebody within your facility that's going to be responsible for training others on human trafficking, that's a great resource. It's a 2-day workshop that they have annually, as well as the National Human Trafficking Training, the Technical Assistance Center, who does SOAR, but they also have core competencies as well. So there's multiple resources out there for healthcare providers, as well as Dignity Health Common Spirit have the PEAR tool. They also have a shared learning manual and a sample policy. So as people are starting to build their policy and response, it just gives an example of what that might look like.
I really appreciate when there is a specific list of things that, you know, people can do or places they can go, places to get resources and training. So if you guys can send that over to us, we will definitely put that all up on our website so our listeners can check that out if they'd like more information. Lisa, you've been working in stopping human trafficking for some time, and Dr. Rivera, I'm sure you also have some stories, but I was wondering if either of you can tell us some stories about victims and kind of how they ended up being trafficked, and then maybe after that, some stories about how people were finally able to get out.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of careful. I feel very responsible in sharing these experiences, you know, to make sure I'm doing it in a responsible way, because I definitely don't want to sensationalize other experiences from someone who's had this lived experience. Survivors that I've met recently that were part of a qualitative study really expressed being trafficked by a family member and then not being identified through their healthcare experiences. It wasn't until they were in the recovery process. So I had a youth that was actually shot, wasn't identified in the hospital, but then was assigned to a visiting nurse because she needed wound care. And so that visiting nurse, she was telling her different places she could meet her, like, meet me at the Jack in the Box, meet me at this fast food restaurant. And the visiting nurse was like, listen, we cannot be doing wound care and dressing changes in the bathroom at Jack in the Box. So she's like, listen, I know you're homeless. Where is your stuff? And literally drove her to the park, picked her stuff up and brought her to shelter. So a lot of times being recruited or trafficked by a family member and then not having that picked up through their healthcare experiences really changed their perception. But it's never too late, right? It's never too late to identify somebody and then ask the questions. And sometimes you really have to bring up the fact that, listen, I know there's something going on. I can get you services. You can trust me. And really taking it to the next level and not just saying, okay. Sometimes you really need to have to ask more questions.
And so I guess a lot of times victims aren't necessarily in school, and that sort of removes a place of finding help. But is there something maybe people who work in education can look for, signs at schools that might be helpful?
Some are actually in schools. And so I don't have statistics on it. And so obviously it's really difficult with human trafficking because it's so underdocumented. We don't have a centralized database to actually track all these occurrences or identification. But there are youth that are going to school. And so this one particular youth that I'm speaking about went to school. And so I think, yeah, there's definitely prevention programs. There's different school systems that actually have curriculum, K-12. San Diego County is one of them. And they do it from a developmentally appropriate approach. So for example, in kindergarten, it might be My Body, My Choice in talking about safe touch, all the way up to 12th grade, where they actually run them through life scenarios and give them different options they can choose. So if somebody's disclosing that they met somebody online and they're meeting at some, you know, undisclosed place, they have two choices. either report that to an adult, a teacher, or a parent, or not say anything. And then it lets them work through that curriculum, as well as it's called the Cool Aunt series. And that was built by a survivor. And so that also gives like a series of 12 videos and curriculum that parents can talk about their children about trafficking with.
Yeah, because it seems like, especially with this particular victim, you know, she was not found in the medical community. She wasn't found within her schooling and educational community. So it seems like those are both great places where she could have been identified, could have gotten resources. And so I think you guys have given us a lot of different ways that we can potentially close some of those loopholes for future victims.
And remember that it's not always sex trafficking, right? Depending on where you are. In California especially, we have a lot of labor trafficking situations in which someone might be presenting to the ER multiple times for standard medical care or even non-standard medical care.
Dehydration.
One that I remember is a patient who presented to the ED for things like you talked about before. You said DKA, but this was things like urinary tract infection. This was hypertension. This was nondescript medical complaints like headaches, abdominal pain, those kinds of things. And a middle-aged to slightly older patient. And they were always accompanied by their boss, who they worked for, who maintained all of their IDs and everything in a nice little organized folder. And the boss also offered to translate, right? It was Vietnamese. So they would always translate, say, oh, we don't need a translator. Let me translate for you. I speak Vietnamese. I'm really worried about my employee. And what it turned out was this was a person who was brought over on a temporary visa from Vietnam, was working in someone's nail salon, basically for free on the promise that they would bring over their other family members, living in an unclean conditions, living, you know, without having a proper access to food and water, where this person maintained all their immigration documents so that they couldn't get away. And it was found out to be a pretty large human trafficking ring for labor, whereas the person who was running the nail salon was collecting all of the income and using these people and immigrants on the promise that they would get their family members to come. And in some cases, on the threat of violence, that their family members would be hurt back home if they didn't stay and work and continue to provide services in the United States. So it doesn't always look like relationships. Sometimes it looks like someone whose boss brought them in for not feeling well on the job at work. And so we just have to be aware that based on where we are, every situation, I say it's like a snowflake, every situation is going to be slightly different. Every survivor is going to have a slightly different response. Every single time you have to customize your approach to this person based on their individual trauma and their willingness to work with you. So that's the crux of it. And that's the hardest part for us, right? Is that we have to customize our approach every single time. And there's no formula that works perfectly. It's just understanding the background and then being able to respond accordingly.
What you guys have really highlighted, I think, is how much it's all around us. It can be at school, it can be at the hospital, it can be at the nail salon, you know, it could be any number of places that you go every day and these people just aren't being seen. So I think this would encourage is just a healthy amount of awareness and looking around you at situations where something might not seem quite right. But then once you identify a victim, having that sense of empathy and respect for what they're going through and providing resources, but not forcing things, are some of the lessons that I've heard from you guys throughout this episode.
Agreed.
What are a couple pearls, you know, maybe one or two in terms of that we can impose to our learners in terms of improving education or awareness, you know, our residents, RN students, you know, medical students, you know, because sometimes it's so busy. There's so much material that they're learning. You know, obviously this is an interest of mine, education, and obviously all of us here. What are ways that we can kind of establish this and places that don't have a curriculum established? How do we start? Or what are a couple pearls that we can kind of, you know, initiate the spark?
Yeah, so I just went through this 3 years ago in really starting to implement evidence-based practice, right? And so first of all, you need a multidisciplinary approach. Because there's certain things as a nurse, like I can definitely do evidence-based practice, translate research into recommendations and education and screening. And as a nurse, I can screen because that's not diagnostic, right? But I'm not a physician. So I'm not billing and coding and diagnosing either. So we really need to work together, especially when it comes to documentation as well. There are some challenges, especially with ICD-10 codes. Like I'm not a physician, so I can't use those. However, when getting buy-in or doing other studies, they will ask me, so how many have we seen? And I'm like, well, if I pull codes, I can check all the asthmatics and I can check all the appendectomies, but it's really hard to see how many exploitation situations we've seen. So it's really working together to see what that looks like for your organization, finding ways to document correctly and then work together on pulling data and then working towards building a comprehensive approach for all disciplines within your facility.
You bring up such a good point. You have to have a plan, right? I think this podcast is a great start to it. You start the process by learning and finding resources to learn more. If your institution doesn't have a formalized, you know, review that you have to take annually for this, like large institutions like UC Irvine, where I work, will have a human trafficking and sex trafficking training program that we have to go through every so many years. If you don't have that, accessing the Department of Health and Human Services or resources and taking their training programs to make sure that you're aware. Which brings me to my second pearl, which is be aware that in any at-risk patient population that you see, you have a possibility of trafficking. So just have it in the back of your mind when the history doesn't make sense, or when the patient seems like they're not responding properly, or when you see or hear some of these red flags, be prepared to address it. And then have a team approach, like Lisa said, and be able to bring in someone who, besides yourself, who can help with it, like a social worker or a care manager or a legal aide or even hospital police if you're in a hospital setting, who might be able to transition easily from hospital police to local law enforcement. And then being able to have discussions about it in practice is another really important pearl, because the more we talk about it, the more we're aware about it and the more we're prepared to deal with it when it happens. So not keeping this as a taboo subject, but talking about it and breaking the stereotypes that we see in media and we see in television, so that we actually know what's going on in our local areas and being prepared for it.
Thank you guys so much for all of that incredible information. Before we wrap this up, do you guys have any final thoughts, anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, I just want to say thank you for providing a platform to talk about these topics that some people in other communities can't even talk about human trafficking. It's really a taboo subject and maybe not brought to the forefront. So thank you for providing the platform so we can talk about this.
Absolutely. Thank you all so much. It's really difficult to talk about this. It's such a wide and encompassing topic that it's impossible to cover in 30 minutes, 40 minutes, an hour. It's something that you have to constantly work at. And I'm really glad for the opportunity to try to break down to the most important things for you. But there's definitely more to learn and more to hear about. So I encourage everyone out there to access some of the resources that we've suggested and really dive in, because there's a lot more to learn.
Thank you both again so much for sharing your expertise and your willingness to really fight against this very under-discussed topic. So thank you again so much for joining us. That's it for this episode. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our guests today were Dr. Ronnie Rivera and Lisa Murdoch. This episode was sponsored by the National Geographic Society's Emergency Fund for Journalists. If you liked this episode, please give us a like, rating, or comment. This is our second to last episode of season 2, so please consider subscribing or follow us on Instagram if you'd like to be notified when we start season 3. Until next time.